Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the third Fetty Night Fight, brought to you by the Federal Society Student Division and the Federal Society at Columbia Law School. Tonight's debate will concern the legal questions at issue in Fulton v. City of Philadelphia, which asks most basically whether a state can compel a Catholic foster care agency to consider placing children with same-sex couples. My name is Cole Campbell, and I'm the co-president of the Federal Society Student Chapter at Columbia Law School. I'm honored to be here tonight to introduce our fighters and our distinguished referee on what is sure to be a fiery but meaningful exchange of ideas on a matter of great importance to both parties and, I hope, to all of us. Now, tonight, we intended to put on a debate with Columbia Law School's Professor Frankie. But about 30 minutes ago, Professor Frankie ran into an emergency situation that unfortunately is foreclosed for her participation. But we, of course, still hope to put on an engaging event for you all who have taken the time to join us. So this event's going to be a little bit different. With very short notice, we are thrilled to welcome a different representative to fight in Professor Frankie's corner, UCLA Law School's Eugene Volokh. So, in one corner, newly, we have Professor Eugene Volokh, a professor of First Amendment law at the UCLA School of Law. Professor Volokh clerked for Sandra Day O'Connor on the United States Supreme Court, and before that, for Alex Kaczynski on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Professor Volokh was born in the USSR and immigrated to the United States when he was just 7 years old, and he went on to graduate from UCLA at the age of 15. And today, with about 15 minutes' notice, he is going to be serving as Professor Lawrence's clerk. And in the other corner, we have Jordan Lawrence, Senior Counsel and Director of Strategic Engagement with the Alliance Defending Freedom. His work concerns religious liberty, free speech, and the vindication of other important interests. He's argued before the United States Supreme Court and various other state Supreme Courts on behalf of his clients. Before joining ADF, Jordan earned his BA from Stanford University and his JD from the University of Minnesota Law School. He also worked for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association and the American Center for Law and Justice. And finally, we're pleased to welcome our referee, the Honorable Judge Jennifer Walker Elrod of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Judge Elrod was appointed to the Fifth Circuit in 2007, and before that, she served as a judge on the 190th District Court of Harris County, Texas, where she spent 5 years presiding over more than 200 trials. Judge Elrod earned her BA from Baylor University and her JD from Harvard Law School, where she was a member of the Harvard Federal Society. Judge Elrod serves on the advisory board for the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, and you might have seen her recent viral theatrical performance making the rounds on the internet with her and Judge Charles Eskridge's parody of Hamilton's We'll Be Back. And tonight, she'll be posing questions and ensuring a clean and fair fight. With that, I will throw it to our distinguished referee, Judge Elrod.
Thank you, Cole, for that introduction. Thank you to the Federalist Society Student Division and Columbia Law Student Chapter for organizing this event. Thank you to Jordan Lawrence and Professor Eugene Volokh, who agreed to enter this ring, Professor Volokh only just momentarily. And we wish Professor Frankie well as well. And thank you to all of you who are virtually attending tonight. We all look forward to a robust discussion rather than an actual fight. We will save time for questions and answers, and I encourage listeners to be thinking of things they would like to ask Jordan Lawrence and Eugene Volokh. Tonight, of course, we will be discussing Fulton versus the City of Philadelphia, a case in which the Supreme Court recently held oral arguments. But before getting to that case, I want to mention two cases that I'm sure our speakers will be referring to. Knowing these cases is helpful background. The first is Employment Division versus Smith, a 1990 opinion authored by Justice Scalia, in which the plaintiffs in this case are asking the court to revisit. Smith held that neutral and generally applicable laws do not violate the free exercise clause of the First Amendment, even when they require or prohibit conduct in contravention of an individual's religious practice. The opinion held that religious exemptions do not need to be evaluated under strict scrutiny, a standard of review that would require the government to assert that the law burdens religious practices is justified by a compelling interest, and the government has used the least restrictive means to further that interest. The other decision to keep in mind in this discussion is Obergefell. In Obergefell v. Hodges, the Supreme Court held that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment guarantees the right to marry as a fundamental liberty, and that this is the same for same-sex couples as it is for opposite-sex couples. Chief Justice Roberts' first question at oral argument in Fulton asked about the tension between free exercise rights at issue in this case and the marriage equality rights in Obergefell. And tonight, I'm sure we will hear about both of these cases. Without further ado, we are going to begin the first round. And with the opening bell, Jordan Lawrence, you are up, sir.
Well, thank you. The oral arguments took place in this case the day after the election. And I think there's probably a majority of the court that wants to rule in favor of Catholic Social Services. And I think that there's a way to do this in which at least three major goals under existing legal doctrines, where there is a maximized number of families available to take foster children, that there is same-sex couples have total opportunity. Every one of them who wants to apply to be a foster parent will have opportunity to do so. And that also to protect and accommodate the religious convictions of Catholic Social Services in this. I think there's a couple of ways that they can do this under the Smith case. Now, maybe we can get into this later. I agree with those who think that the Supreme Court should overrule Employment Division v. Smith, but I don't think there didn't seem to be a lot of interest in doing that. And I think there's at least two ways that they can reach a very good result in all this. And one of the results I just want to say as well is that there can be peaceful coexistence between the supporters of same-sex marriage, those who are in same-sex marriages, and the people who believe either by religious beliefs or philosophical beliefs that marriage is defined only as one man and one woman. And we had this, how do we resolve that, come up in one context with Masterpiece, Cake Shop. Here is another example of it. And I'm hoping we can reach out there. So first, I just want to talk a little bit about the facts of this case and what's going on this. So the Catholic Church has been in Philadelphia, has been taking care of children in need for 200 years. That back in the 1790s, they were caring for children whose parents had died in the yellow fever epidemic of the 1790s. And they just continued through the 1800s. And around 50 years ago, the city of Philadelphia started entering into this play, into this space of caring for children and partnered with some of the pre-existing groups that were already there, like Catholic Social Services, which started working with foster children and other orphans, et cetera, back in 1917. Now the state's, the government's role, the city of Philadelphia's role has grown over the time. Now, the Catholic agency, of course, takes any child in need. It doesn't matter their race, their religion, their sexual orientation, their gender identity. They care for all of them. But they do have religious beliefs because of their doctrine that they will not certify a couple that is unmarried or same sex. So I want to explain a little bit more how this system works and shows that I think that it has a pathway of solution here. So when a child is neglected or abused and comes into the custody of the city of Philadelphia, it puts the word out to 30 agencies that it has contracted with and said, we've got these particular kids, you know, an eight-year-old boy, a six-year-old sister, they're this race, there's this religion. Who of you have families that can take them in? And these 30 agencies talk to their families and then put back to the city of Philadelphia offers of families that can take them. And then the city of Philadelphia decides, taking factors like the race, the religion, the location of, you know, for example, they want the kid to stay in the school that he's going to, and chooses where the family goes. Now that's the point where money starts changing hands, where the city of Philadelphia is paying these agencies for both the parents, the care of the kid, as well as the administration. The acquiring of the families is something that goes on beyond the contract. Now, these agencies have to do that so they have eligible families to take kids for placement. But that's all a different operation that's not controlled by the city, and they have to meet criteria that are under state law. Now, what is very interesting about all of this is how I think there has been this a number of referrals, this system, a culture of referring people to other agencies, because this is how the families get involved in this. If there's some family that thinking, we want to be a foster parent, they have to go through training, be investigated, certified by these agencies. And the city says, go to one of these 30 agencies, investigate them, find the one that's the best fit, and then apply to them. Now, sometimes these families have unique skills or whatever, and they're not really aware of which agency would be the best one for them. So reading through the record, and this didn't come out so much in the oral arguments, it was astonishing to me how much referring goes back and forth between these agencies. So there, it's sort of a spontaneous ordering to maximize the efficiency of what's going on. So for example, somebody can apply and they live too far away from the agency. So they'll be referred to one that's closer to them. Because once these families are certified and they get a child from the city, they have to work with them through the agency. It's not like the agency signs off. It's this very intense and frequent interaction between these agencies, the parents, the city, to make sure the child is getting the best care. The agency might have a waiting list. They'll refer someone to someone else. The applicant might wish to foster Native American children, which has special legal requirements, and there's some of these 30 groups specialize in that. The parents may speak a language other than English. So for example, there's two of these agencies that deal with Spanish-speaking children, which would be more helpful for children that speak Spanish to be put in a home where the foster parents can communicate with them. If there's, for example, the family has medical expertise, they're both doctors, they're both nurses. There are some of these agencies that will specialize in groups that deal with behavioral issues or medical issues, and other groups don't. And these agencies then will refer these parents to someone else. Pregnant teens is another one. Specialization, somebody's interested in that, they happen to call the wrong agency, they'll get redirected to that. Now, what has happened with all of this is that this is specialization in service of efficiency. It has this spontaneous ordering has basically created made this system more effective by maximizing the number of number of families that can take foster children. It has allowed opportunities for any same-sex couple that wants to apply to see if they qualify to be certified. They can do that, and also accommodates the beliefs of the Catholics. And I think it's a win-win-win. Now, what happened here is that the city found out that they read in a newspaper article and some reporter asked Catholic Social Services, what would they do if a same-sex couple came? And they said, well, that's never happened. But if it did, if a same-sex couple came, we referred them to one of the other agencies. And there's at least three or four that have gotten a award from various gay groups, from the Human Rights Campaign. And in fact, I'm not even sure that any of the other 29 say no to same-sex couples or unmarried couples the way that the Catholics do. But this caused alarm among various city officials. And so, for example, the city council passed an ordinance that said, decrying this, and the city basically said, we're going to put into our contract a non-discrimination policy, which the Catholics said we could not in faith do, and they were cut off from receiving any more children. Now, there were already children in foster care with families that were associated with Catholic Social Services, and they continue, but those numbers are dwindling. Yet, even at this time, the city of Philadelphia put out a public call for 300 new households to take foster kids at the same time when they were cutting off Catholic social services. Now, how does the Supreme Court fit that into current doctrine? Now, they could overrule Employment Division v. Smith so that the city would have to have a compelling governmental interest done by the least restrictive means to do this. I don't think they're going to go that far in this case, but there are two other things that I think that they could do. They could choose, and maybe right now they're weighing those. One of them is hostility towards religion. In Masterpiece Cake Shop, this is a case that where I work, Alliance Defending Freedom did. The Supreme Court resolved the free exercise issue by pointing to the comments made by members of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission that were negative about the religious beliefs of Jack Phillips, and they basically said that was not a basis that they could rule against him and reverse that ruling. Here we have something similar going on. The city council passed an ordinance that said, a resolution that said that what Catholic social services are doing is discrimination taking place under the guise of religious freedom. The mayor had the Philadelphia Commission on Human Rights open an investigation against Catholic social services, but that didn't come to anything. And then the commissioner who deals with the foster children came to Catholic social services and tried to say, look, this isn't 100 years ago. You got to change your ways, and pointed them to the teachings of Pope Francis and said, why can't you be more like him? And what I think, this isn't maybe necessarily hostility, but at least raises eyebrows to have a government official telling someone in a Catholic organization that they're not interpreting their own church's doctrine and theology the right way. Maybe there's some establishment clause problems there. Now, the other way, and I think that this may be the way that they do this, is that the Smith decision says that if the law is neutral on its face towards religion and generally applicable, then you can't bring a free exercise clause. So it's not neutral if you have negative statements being made by the government officials, but it's also, Smith says, it's also not generally applicable if there is a system of individualized assessments that go on of evaluating people or institutions on a case-by-case basis to decide that. And I think we have this here. So even the contract provision itself that says no discrimination has, unless there is a waiver done by the commissioner. There's also a general committee that they have that waives contract provisions that people can apply to do this. Now, the exemptions here, I think that they have to justify why the system that worked before, where there was all this spontaneous ordering, this self-selection, where maximizing the number of children that had foster homes, the homes for foster children that allowed same-sex couples to all that wanted to could apply, as well as accommodating the Catholics' beliefs, that did not work, that they had to come in and say, basically, every person has got to be able to apply to any one of the 30 agencies. But then they're still allowing all this referring by the groups to others because it just would not be efficient for them just to say, I'm whatever family randomly decides to apply to one group, that they're stuck with them, that they cannot refer people to maximize the sufficiency. So I just think in this instance here, with this situation, what was existing prior to what City of Philadelphia did when they imposed this order in 2018 was a system that worked. And by what they have done now is they've eliminated one of their providers for foster care. So children have to languish in group homes because willing parents are not being allowed to do it unless they, and if you think, well, why don't they go to one of the other 29 agencies? They would have to start from the very square one to be qualified to be able to do that. This is, Philadelphia has basically tried to solve a problem that did not exist. And I think the solution would be to go back to the way it was because it was working efficiently and no one was being discriminated against. And I think that that's the promise of Obergefell and Masterpiece Cake Shop. How do we have peaceful coexistence and mutual dignity between these groups? And that's what was happening in Philadelphia before the city stepped in.
Thank you, Jordan. Eugene?
Yeah, so Philadelphia has a job to do. It has what is these days at least perceived as a government function. If children end up without parents, they need to place them in some home or through foster care. That's an important government function. Philadelphia could, if it wanted to, perform this function itself using its own employees. It could just say, you know, if there's a child who's orphaned, let's say, we're going to try to line up somebody. And we have a staff of people who do that, who screen prospective parents. And of course, we'll tell our staff that they shouldn't discriminate based on certain criteria. That would be our policy. Maybe it's a good policy, maybe it's a bad policy. It's our choice, it's our discretion. If that were so, then it's pretty clear that religious entities or secular entities that say, no, we want to help administer this program, they'd be out of court. Nobody has a right to participate in this kind of government program. But for, I think, pretty good reasons, the city decided to essentially hire out, not on an employment basis, but kind of on a contract basis, hire out this function to nonprofits, many of whom, for example, have very good connections with various communities, may be particularly good at, as Jordan pointed out, at screening people in particular ways. But the city takes the view that should insist that those groups also, generally speaking, not discriminate. Maybe it's a short-sighted view. Maybe it's too zealous in the pursuit of non-discrimination above all. Maybe some amount of toleration of discrimination coupled with referrals would be a more sensible approach. Maybe. But it seems to me that that is a judgment that the Constitution and the Free Exercise Clause leaves to the city, that the city is entitled to say, if you want to participate in this program, then if you want us to listen to you when you tell us, oh, we think this couple is good for this child, and we aren't willing to certify, if you want to listen to us, you got to play by our rules. And if you don't want to play by our rules, that's fine. You can provide lots of other services. Just you won't get this very unusual factor of participation in this decision about who gets to foster parent. So that's what the city of Philadelphia is doing here. And I don't think that the Free Exercise Clause stands in its way in this context. Now, to be sure, this formal non-discrimination rule appears to have been implemented recently, but that's in part because, especially when it comes to government running its own programs, it often starts with a limited set of rules. And then when things that trouble it arise, that's when it enacts new rules. So it may be that beforehand it hadn't really focused on it. Maybe it just assumed that various entities wouldn't discriminate, or it just wasn't top of its list. But now that it sees that there is this discrimination that is apparently happening, and by the way, my view is it's not a terribly harmful form of discrimination. Maybe it's the sort of discrimination that entities should be allowed to engage in, but that's not the city's view. In running its program, it concludes it wants to basically eliminate such discrimination, except within a very, very few contexts. So what about the fact that the city seems to be hostile to something here? I do think the city is hostile to something. But I don't see any reason to think that it's hostile to Catholicism. It is hostile to a particular practice that is associated with at least people who believe in a particular type of Catholicism, the practice of preference for traditional marriage over non-marital couples or same-sex marriage. That is a practice that is entitled to be hostile to. It's the job of the government to decide which behavior that may have secular effects is something that it approves of or disapproves of. Now, there are some constraints on that, maybe in some situations. I mean, for example, if the city were to say, no, you cannot discriminate based on sex and whom you marry. Well, that would be pretty ridiculous. No city tries to do that, but it would violate the right to marry. And therefore, the city can't impose its non-discrimination rules in that situation. But I think it can impose its non-discrimination rules on those who want to engage in this kind of city-delegated authority to make these kinds of decisions about the qualities of couples. And if in the process it's hostile to a view that opposite-sex marriage is the only kind of couple that is worthy parenting children, then it's entitled to implement that hostility into its rules, because again, it's hostility to a practice. It's kind of like in Employment Division versus Smith. Was the state of Oregon hostile to something? Yes, it was hostile to peyote use. But that wasn't enough to make that practice religiously discriminatory in the Supreme Court's views, because it wasn't hostility to the peyote churches as such. It was just disapproval of a particular practice that secular as well as religious people may engage in. So if you think about it, by the way, this issue comes up in a wide, wide range of contexts, right? If a city as employer wants to hire employees, it may be required, it may require them to do certain things. There are limits on that imposed by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, that there's a not strict scrutiny of government action that burdens employees religious practice, just the requirement of reasonable accommodation. But that's a statutory choice that Congress enacted through Title VII. Likewise, there's a Pennsylvania statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which involved Pennsylvania's legislature imposing certain extra restraints on governments. But that's not before the court right now for reasons we can talk about later. The Constitution doesn't require the state to hire or government entities to hire people and at the same time tolerate those people's religious practices, religiously motivated practices, when they violate secular norms that the government as employer prescribes. Seems to me the same rule would apply to the government government when it's contracting things out. I know there are particular details we can talk about how what the relevance is of certain exemptions for disability discrimination, very narrow exceptions for race discriminations. I will say, we can talk about them in the Q&A, but I think that probably most people aren't terribly interested in that. I will close with two things. One is, when Employment Division versus Smith talked about how there is a remnant of requirement of kind of religious exemptions under the Free Exercise Clause, it was pointing to cases which involved individualized governmental assessment of the reasons for the relevant conduct. That's an employment compensation, where basically you're entitled to collect unemployment compensation when you leave your job for good reason and when you are open to other jobs, but declined to take some other proposed job for good reason. And the court said in that context, when there's a pretty free form determination, what's good reason? Oh, it's too far away from you. Oh, it interferes with childcare responsibilities. Oh, you're overqualified for it. Oh, you're underqualified for it. If this is kind of a case by case determination of good reason, well, religious reasons ought to be treated the same way. I think that's pretty far from what's going on here, whereas a general matter with very, very few exceptions, there is this non-discrimination rule, at least as I understand it. So let's just step back and summarize. This is the government deciding how to run its programs. Sometimes it makes those decisions wisely, sometimes unwisely, sometimes counterproductively. I'm perfectly willing to except the government sometimes does that. Maybe it's doing it here. Maybe, again, it's too obsessed with non-discrimination above all. But it's running its own programs. It's giving programs that give entities like Catholic Social Services rights to participate in a governmental process that the rest of us don't have. So if I were to say, oh, I want to go and help decide who's going to be a suitable foster parent, and say, well, okay, you know, you're not part of this program. Maybe you could apply for it, but there's no reason we particularly would need to let you in. And certainly as an ordinary citizen, you're not entitled to get access to it. So in this kind of context, the city ought to be able to say, you want us to listen to you? You want us to give kind of legal effect to your decisions? Got to play by our rules. And that, it seems to me, is something that the free exercise clause, certainly under Employment Division versus Smith, allows the city to do.
Thank you, Gene. Jordan?
I guess I'm a little surprised at how deferential Eugene is being to the government here, this is a function. I mean, just sort of the general libertarian philosophy, I thought there would be a little more warmth to what I was saying with all of this. But I think that I dispute your characterization of this is that this is something that the government has been, you know, they're obviously in control now and they're setting the rules. But for decades, they basically did not occupy this space and they allowed the private groups to do it. And then in the last 50 years, this started out as a partnership and it's been sort of a takeover of this. And maybe that's appropriate, but the Catholics are not these Johnny come latelys that have come to this and are demanding special treatment that nobody else gets. It's basically the government coming in and forcing a rule that basically messes up a system that already worked. Now, constitutionally too, I'm thinking of the Hobby case, not Hobby Lobby, but a Hobby case from I think like around 1986, where the Supreme Court said there is a duty to accommodate religious beliefs. And I think if you have government expanding into more and more areas, that there's a correlative duty for the government to accommodate. So like, you know, religious pacifists have no conflict with the government until there's a military draft. The Hobby Lobby and the Little Sisters of the Poor don't have any conflict until Obamacare comes on the scene. And so I just think that if you kind of start at the point where the government is taken over and saying, hey, they're just having neutral rules, I think that that's not the right place to start. And it just means that the religious users are always going to lose in that kind of situation. They never have to be accommodated because that's what I see as the main problem with Employment Division v. Smith, is that these the government, then even if they have reasons that are not significant, they always win in these kind of situations.
So I am libertarian-ish as a matter of policy, but I don't think the Free Exercise Clause enacts a libertarian vision of religious exemptions. That is, in fact, what the court held in Employment Division versus Smith, controversially, to be sure, but that is what it held. So that is especially so, it seems to me, when, again, it's the government running government programs. It's not the government sort of telling people what they can do in their own homes or even in their own businesses. It's saying, again, if you want us to listen to you in your judgment about who is a fit foster parent, we want you to follow certain rules. Now, it is true that foster parenting historically had often been arranged through religious entities, and I think it's very much to their credit. Nonetheless, this is something that is understandably viewed, certainly today, as a government function. Again, we're not talking about, in foster parenting, about people controlling their own lives. We're talking about who gets to control other people's lives, little people's lives, mm-hmm. right? So if you have if you have children whose parents are dead or parents are unable to help them, then the law, by putting them in a foster home, is giving these foster parents power over these children in certain measure. And unsurprisingly, modern government takes the view that we should help decide who it is. So in fact, we should have the ultimate decision-making power on who it is, who has this, because they'll only have access to these children. They only have this power because the law allows them to do that. So it seems to me quite reasonable that this should be an area where the government ought to have a considerable amount of freedom. freedom, let me be more specific, considerable amount of latitude in deciding, again, whom it listens to in making these placements. Finally, let me just close with Employment Division versus Smith, because now that we are at this question of whether it should be overruled, let me just close with one hypothetical. And I think we'll have plenty of time to explore. Jordan, I'd love to hear your thoughts, probably during Q&A, and I think students may answer it too. Back in the late 1990s, in 1997, I think, the Supreme Court dealt with, in fact, a libertarian claim, a claim of our right to assisted suicide. And the Supreme Court rejected that claim. And it said, among other things, that this is subject to the rational basis test, not subject to strict scrutiny, because deciding whether to allow assisted suicide involves very contested and difficult moral questions and difficult practical questions. When is life valuable? Is it all life is valuable, or only life of people who want to keep on living that is valuable enough, more specifically, for the government to protect through the threat of criminal sanctions for those who want to help end it? Also, even if you say, if somebody really wants to die, they should be entitled to do that, there are questions about how we sort those who really want to die from those who don't. So there's a practical question of whether these less restrictive means are going to be effective. That too is a difficult and contested question. And the Supreme Court said, look, we know we've recognized some libertarian rights under the rubric of substantive due process. We don't really want to grow this category much. The Constitution does not enact a broadly libertarian system where people are free to do what they wish, or even what they wish so long as it doesn't hurt others. It's left to the legislative process. So the interesting thing is, if we were in a Sherbert v. Verner world, a pre-Employment Division versus Smith world, or other world that lasted from 1963 to about 1990, the people who wanted to either be helped commit suicide or to help others commit suicide had a religious claim, kind of like we want to be good Samaritans, although Samaritans who help those who want to die, help them die, then all of these difficult moral and pragmatic questions that the court managed, I think quite correctly, Doc, in Washington v. Glucksberg, it would have to consider just as to religious objectors, because the religious objectors would presumably have this presumptive right under the Free Exercise Clause as a constitutional matter, not just as a statutory matter, not overcomable by the legislature, just as a constitutional matter. And that's not just that. It's as to employment discrimination laws and minimum wage laws and a vast range of other laws where somebody, where the court says we're going to avoid all of these problems of making these moral and pragmatic judgments by leaving it to the rational basis test and therefore for the political process. All of those, the duty to, or claims of a right to refuse to testify on religious grounds, all of those would be returned to the courts to decide, at least when somebody is making a religious objection. I think that's something the court rightly avoided with Employment Division versus Smith, and I don't think it should want to go back into that business again.
Well, let me just add one thing here, just quickly, is that I think that, and I mean, you raised some excellent points, but I think the more likely scenario is I can see a future administration taking over the medical system and saying there's a right to assisted suicide, and basically saying to doctors and nurses employed by the government-run healthcare system that if you don't participate in this, you lose your jobs. And you have, you know, this is a general rule that applies to everybody, and we're going to grant no religious accommodation. And so I think that that's kind of that's a different scenario than what you're talking about. But I think that is something that when government grows, we shouldn't have religious liberty shrink or right of conscience shrink.
But if the government really is an employer there, then of course the government can say to doctors and hospitals, at least consistent with the Free Exercise Clause, if you want to be hired at our hospital, then you've got to perform the operations we want you to hire. But we want you to hire. We're hiring you to do. Now, again, Title VII is a judgment by Congress. And there ought to be a modest, not strict scrutiny, but a modest level of exemption from that. But that's a statutory choice. I don't think the Constitution should demand that.
So Eugene, just want to make sure I got this right. If the government goes into a sphere and dominates the sphere and takes it over, then it can have any rules it likes, even if they burden religious people. So if they take over all the hospitals, they can have, this was a hypo at the actual argument, I think that Justice Barrett asked, and she didn't ask it about assisted suicide. I think she asked it about abortion, right, requiring every doctor in the hospital system to perform abortions or certain percentage of them or something. And then would this be discriminatory against Catholics? The same thing for schools. The more that the government decides we're going to run all the grocery stores and we're going to run all of the government's going to run the entire economy. We're going to be a centrally planned country. Does that mean that the government then can have all of these rules then? And that where do religious people's rights kick in under this theory?
So let's look at Employment Division versus Smith. There, the government didn't even really have, at least the way the court conceptualized the case, a hook of the government as employer or government as contractor. There, the government had a law that made it a crime to use peyote, just a crime. And by the way, throughout early American history, there were no drug laws. My understanding is they're generally a creature of the early 1900s. To be sure, at the state level, there were some alcohol bans, but pervasively, they didn't come around until the early 1900s. And Justice Scalia's response was, well, maybe that the government has now, he didn't even articulate as taking over the field. It just creating criminal laws to ban things that before were not banned, but it's entitled to do that, and nobody gets an exemption from that. So under Employment Division versus Smith, if the government can criminalize the use of peyote, then yes, if the government is actually taking over some field and actually running it itself, then in that case, it's even clearer it can, as a condition of employment or condition of contract, so impose the same rules. Now, one thing that I think is important about this field is, again, this isn't like the government just saying, I'm going to take over grocery stores. It's the government saying, we're going to take over the decision about who is going to have custody, who other than the birth parents is going to have custody of a child. That is quite suitably a government decision. That is a decision that understandably it's the government and not just some third party that's going to be making. So I think this is a particularly sensible place for the government to say that. But yes, under Employment Division versus Smith, the government doesn't have to be limited to its authority as employer or as contractor. It can impose criminal laws. Now, what's the constraint on that? Justice Scalia was asked that essentially. And in the Smith opinion, he said the constraint is the political process. That there could be religious exemptions obtained. And in fact, it has turned out that one way or another, most American jurisdictions, including Pennsylvania, have statutes like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which I actually support, precisely because they're not constitutional mandates, but rather statutory mandates subject to revision the way statutes are, where religious objectors do have such exemptions. Likewise, Congress enacted in Title VII an exemption for employees even of private businesses, which employees have taken advantage, for example, of saying, you know, I don't want to participate in performing abortions. And there are special statutes that actually protect specifically employees that do not want to perform abortions. So I think that's rightly left to the political process. Let's just step back a little bit more broadly. What about this religious person who feels I have a religious obligation to participate in assisted suicide? I think the general answer is, okay, that's your felt religious obligation. We understand that. But if we have a generally applicable law forbidding assisted suicide, we don't have to give you a special exemption just because you believe it's really, really, really wrong. That is to say, the law is really, really, really wrong. I think that's the premise of Employment Division versus Smith, and I think it's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Eugene. Jordan, did you want to respond? I do have a question for you, too. I'm not just
going to call Eugene. I would say, though, that there is kind of an implicit standard of, maybe it's not a compelling state interest, but of some significant state interest. So somebody says, I have a religious belief that I have to participate in assisted suicide. That would be similar to somebody says, I have a belief that it's a sin to pay taxes. And the governmental interest is at a point where they can say, look, We cannot allow exemptions from this general rule. But in other situations, I think the government imposes rules out of convenience. Their interests are not that significant, that sort of thing. And that it is good for them to be put to the test to why they're not granting an exemption to somebody who disapproves of the situation. And I would say in this this situation, even though we're talking about custody of children, there's all sorts of the factors that the government says are illegal when they're placing the children, the race, their religion, things like this, the marital status of the couples, all these things that they say, the city says, we are bound not to do that. They employ all those all the time. And so I think, well, then why can't you grant an exemption? And in fact, when this system was working before you imposed this in 2018, we had efficiency. We had, it seems like a least restrictive means. It's not like, and it would have been a different situation if there were all sorts of same-sex couples that lacked the opportunity to apply to be foster care, foster parents, but they were able to do it. So I'm not I don't understand what their governmental interest is that they were trying to fix, except a very generalized statement about avoiding discrimination, which I think at one level wasn't even happening here because no same-sex couple was denied the ability to apply to be a foster parent.
Well, you know, we haven't talked about the stigma yet in this discussion. We've been talking about government power and what's the government sphere. But during the argument in the Supreme Court, there was some lengthy discussion and questioning about the Loving case. In the lead up to Loving v. Virginia, people from several faith traditions made religious arguments against interracial marriage. And an oral argument in this case, several justices questioned whether this case would be different if the agency refused to certify interracial couples as foster parents on religious grounds. Would a ruling in CSS's favor in this case set the stage for such a result? How would you distinguish the Loving hypothetical, or can you? That's a question for you, Jordan.
Well, I would say this, is that, first of all, it hasn't happened. And if it did happen, I think that the government could say something like race is unique with the badges and incidents of slavery under the 13th Amendment, that it might be different. But I would say this too, is that even the governmental's interest for race is not a interest sufficient to suppress, for example, freedom of speech rights. Now, how this would play out, I don't know, but somebody can inflict serious dignitary harm on Black people with what they say, and that doesn't give the government an excuse to censor them. But the other thing too is that in Obergefell itself, the Justice Kennedy characterized, he said this, that many who deem same-sex marriage to be wrong reach that conclusion based on decent and honorable religious or philosophical premises, and neither they nor their beliefs are disparaged here. And there's not a statement like that about people who believe interracial marriage is wrong. And in fact, I would say in light of Masterpiece, there's more of a the last sentence of the Masterpiece decision, Justice Kennedy is saying, looking for a balance where we can have peaceful coexistence between those who are in same-sex marriages and believe in it with those who believe marriage is limited to one man and one woman. And I think that this is what they had in Philadelphia before the rule was imposed, was a peaceful coexistence.
So my just quick response is, I do think that people have the right to discriminate in various ways in certain contexts. We see that in Boy Scouts v. Dale. We see that in Hurley, the parade case. I'm all in favor of that when they're just doing it themselves. But when the government is operating a program and is selecting people who participate in the program and is using contractors or its own employees, again, I think this is interchangeable here, to administer the program, it could say, we don't want to do anything that causes even a modest amount of stigma, or more to the point, whether it causes stigma or not, we just don't want to do anything, perhaps with a few narrow exceptions, that discriminates based on certain criteria. Again, it's something it could insist that its staff do if it operates this program through its staff. I think it's something it could insist its contractors do. And I think it can do that quite consistently with the language from Obergefell. I do think that, for example, a wedding photographer, I've filed a brief in one such case, unfortunately, unpersuasively to the court, but...
My case.
Pardon?
It was my case, yes.
Exactly. that a wedding photographer should be free not to create same-sex wedding photographs. I'll go further. If a wedding photographer doesn't want to create wedding photographs of interracial weddings, she should be free not to do that. My wife and I'm Jewish, she's not. Some photographers may view that as kind of impermissible intermarriage, probably more likely some Jewish photographers rather than non-Jewish ones. And if one of them told me, I'm sorry, I don't want to photograph your wedding, I think they'd have every right to do that. But if the government decided it wanted to provide subsidized photographs or as part of, let's say, the UC system, it have photographs of UC faculty members' weddings, then it could insist that the photographers it hires for that particular task go along with its rules. Judge, I think you are muted.
You're muted.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. I think you've acquitted yourself very well in this pseudo boxing match.
I want all judges to feel that I'm acquitted.
No promises there, Eugene. We're now going to open the conversation up to the audience. And so I hope you don't take any blows from them, but they will be asking some questions. I do have some instructions for you, audience members. If you're on the phone, you need to dial *9. If you're in the chat feature, you should raise your hand. We have a couple of hand raises in the chat feature. I will call on you. I do ask that you make your questions brief. Fair warning, I will cut you off if you give a speech instead of ask a question. And I have no, you're warned, but we do appreciate your questions. We'll begin with Sean Callahan, Sean's had his or her hand up for a long time.
Hello, thank you, Judge. My question is whether that Smith can be overruled or at least conformed to Yoder through Lukumi by revivifying the sincerely held religious belief tests. I think it's commonly supposed that the rationale for Smith is that judges can't possibly say whose beliefs are sincere. I think it's more that judges don't want to say what beliefs are religious, but is it really true under the original public meaning of the First Amendment that we can't say whether a belief in killing yourself is a religious belief or other similar such determinations?
Well, my view is that the current law allows the government to decide what's a sincere belief and what's not. In fact, requires it under various RFRAs.
Yes.
But what it can't decide is whether the belief is central to a religion or is true religion. And it also can't reject beliefs because they're unfamiliar or kind of parts of a very small religious beliefs or even are idiosyncratic. So there are debates about the original public meaning of the free exercise clause and whether it's more like Smith or more like Sherbert or maybe more like something in between. But I see no way in which a court can say, you believe that the parable of the Good Samaritan means you should help kill people who seek death, seek a mercy killing? No, you're clearly lying. Doesn't matter how sincere you seem, doesn't matter what other people testify that you're sincere, you must be lying. Or even if you're not lying, that's just wrong. That's just not a religious belief. I can't see how that would be so. Now, it may not be the standard way that most Christians would interpret the parable of the Good Samaritan, but Doesn't have to be. In fact, I think one feature of the Establishment Clause is the government can say this is true Christianity or this is really popular Christianity, that is to say something a lot of people believe in, and that's something therefore we would prefer over something that is weird or idiosyncratic. So yes, it seems to me that while you can use the substantial burden threshold to get rid of cases where the person is making stuff up in a way that you can say, at least by preponderance of the evidence, I think he's lying. But you can't get rid of claims because they're somehow inconvenient or they're unusual or they're contrary to the judge's own view of what religion ought to be.
Jordan, can I just add, I agree with what Eugene is saying. And I would say that, if the religion seems to be a pretext, so for example, I think that that comes up in some financial fraud situations where somebody, they're purporting that it's religious, but they're just basically doing some kind of thing to, you know, get tax benefits or whatever and setting up a, you know, a fake church and their name's Bob and they set up the Church of Bob or something like that, that's where the sincerity issue comes in. And I agree. You don't judge the centrality. I think you can judge the sincerity, but I don't think that's usually the issue. It's the compelling state interest and the least restrictive means is usually, and the substantial burden. Those are the factors that are usually at issue in religious liberty cases and free exercise cases.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. Next question comes from Tori Rhodes.
Hi, thank you, Judge. Please tell me if I'm completely off base, but when I was hearing Professor Eugene, I was thinking and wondering if from the government's perspective, can their opposition be likened to something similar to a Bastion peremptory challenge, that as a private actor participating in a government program, they could be viewed as a state actor for equal protection purposes? Meaning that the private actor is discriminating not on the basis of sexual orientation, but because of the same sex?
Interesting. So the question is whether it would be constitutionally compelled under the Equal Protection Clause for the government to insist that anybody participating in this foster care process, foster care screening process, not discriminate. It's an interesting question. I think the Batson cases are pushing the boundaries of what is state action. Even if they're correct, I don't think that the court is likely to go considerably beyond them. I think if a city were to say, look, we will allow screening by entities, even without any non-discrimination rule, so long as they're willing to refer people so that every couple will get somebody who'd be willing to screen them. I think that would be within its authority. I don't think that would violate the Equal Protection Clause for the city to take a hands-off approach to that. But I do think that the city is entitled to take a hands-on approach. And again, one way of thinking about it is if this were all done by government employees and the manager of the program sends out a memo saying, all of you folks who are being paid in order to run this program, I'm telling you, you have to follow these rules. Seems to me that would be constitutional. And the fact that it's being done through contractors, I don't think changes the analysis.
Jordan, did you have anything to add?
Well, I would just add that the city of Philadelphia has never claimed that the contracting agencies are state actors, that has not been their argument. In fact, that they've said, we have nothing to do with the recruiting and investigative process to certify the foster parents. They're not liable for any problems they do, that sort of thing. So there's much more of a hands-off approach here that they have with this kind of situation.
Right. And actually, if I just mention one thing, just because this is doctrine and it's good for law students to appreciate the value of doctrine. I actually think there is a binding precedent more or less on this broad question. And I shouldn't say binding precedent, precedents that bear on this question. We know from a case called Rendell Baker versus Cohn that when the government is even paying 90% of the budget of a private contractor, it is not, does not make the private contractor a state actor. In that case, it was a school for children, I forget, with some kinds of problems. And it was very heavily subsidized by the state, but it was not actually run by the state. And a teacher, I think, sued saying her First Amendment rights were violated by the school. Court says that's not a state actor. On the other hand, you have Bob Jones University versus United States, where the government says we're going to deny tax exemption, which is a form of subsidy, to institutions that discriminate based on race. And the court there upheld that under strict scrutiny. And in Employment Division versus Smith, the court actually gave Bob Jones as an example of a kind of case where under the Employment Division versus Smith there, rule, there shouldn't be any heightened scrutiny. Now you can debate whether the result, whether Smith is right, of course, on this, but the important point is there are a lot of situations where the government doesn't have to enforce non-discrimination rules because there's no state action, but is entitled to if it wants to.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Corbin Kaufman.
Yes, I was curious about for the religious animus argument under Masterpiece Cake Shop. My understanding is that both the district court and the Third Circuit have already kind of analyzed factually elements of animus. So I was wondering what you expect the court might do on that front, remanding for more factual hearings or sort of looking at the facts themselves, or how should they treat the facts in that regard under the Masterpiece Cake Shop argument?
Jordan, you want to?
Yeah, I'll start with that. This is just my gut feel from listening a couple of times. I listened twice to the oral arguments straight through. I think they're going to be more. I think that's possible that they could say, "Hey, we said religious animus in a Masterpiece Cake Shop. This is kind of similar, and rule in favor of Catholic Social Services on that grounds." My hunch is, though, I think they're going to be more attracted to the fact that there's a lot of individualized exemptions in this built into this system. There's a lot of, just basically making decisions on a case-by-case basis, that sort of thing, which will be the basis that they, if they rule in favor of Catholic Social Services, I think that's going to be the grounds that they're going to take.
Yeah, I generally agree with the part, and more broadly, I think that that the evidence here of real religious animus is just not strong enough, especially given that indeed the district court essentially said, and the presence of animus is a factual matter, said there's not sufficient evidence.
And that brings up, you're talking about what you think the opinion will say. If you could write the opinion, and this was your world, what would the opinion say? And if the decision were to come out opposite of the way you would want it to, what would you foresee as the worst consequences of the decision?
Jordan, you want to start?
Well, if I were to write the decision, I would either, depend if I get four other votes, was to overturn Employment Division v. Smith and apply the compelling state interest test, or, as I laid out at the beginning, rule that this was there was a lot of individualized exceptions here, and that they basically had a working system that basically did not result in discrimination against same-sex couples, and that that's what they should return to, and that it also maximized the number of families available for foster children and accommodated the religious beliefs of the Catholics. What I think is what are the consequence, and with cases like Masterpiece Cake Shop, I do think that there's sort of this continuum of how much we see more and more people accepting the notion of same-sex marriage. People that believe in the traditional view of marriage are diminishing, and how much ostracism can the government impose on those who believe the wrong way? So if we lose this, I think it would be kind of more like, what's the next step? Is it going to be families who believe marriage is one man and one woman? They cannot apply to be foster parents. Nonprofit groups like churches that say, we believe marriage is only one man and one woman. They lose their tax exempt status because we shouldn't be subsidizing discrimination or something like that. And I feel that cases like Masterpiece and A Win Here for Catholic Services basically create safe space for people who have the minority position. And I think it's, just as a general First Amendment matter, it's good to carve out those enclaves to protect those who have the minority view. And if those in control with the prevailing orthodoxy can just say, well, we're going to call you discriminators and just kind of wipe you out. You know, we're going to file bar complaints against all the attorneys at Alliance Defending Freedom to, you know, revoke their licenses to practice law, you know, things like that. That sort of thing should not be allowed to happen. And I think that there will be incentivized if the case goes the wrong way.
Can I share the screen for just a moment? Because I've got the opening paragraph all written up already. So it's right here. This is,
and you
this
came
is,
on in 15 minutes yes, notice. That's pretty impressive.
Impressive that you, well, you're filling in and you've written an opening paragraph.
This is the opening paragraph of my amicus brief in the case. So Justice Scalia was right. Courts should not be constantly in the business of determining whether the severe impact of various laws and religious practice suffices to justify constitutionally required religious exemptions from a generally applicable law. It is horrible to contemplate that federal judges will regularly balance against the importance of general laws, the significance of religious practice in determining whether the Constitution mandates an exemption from a general state law. And then I would give some of the illustrations, just like Justice Scalia gave in my brief. I mentioned, again, assisted suicide laws or claims of religious exemptions from the duty to testify. Some Jews, for example, take the view that they cannot testify against their parents or children. Some Muslims have taken the view that they can't testify when they think that would serve injustice or can't testify against a fellow Muslim. These are all sincere religious beliefs. They cannot be something that trumps generally applicable law as a constitutional matter, and the government and the courts have no yardstick by which to decide that. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is that, of course, government entities, or let's say states and the federal government as to federal law, is entitled to carve out religious exemptions so long as they're suitably neutral. And in fact, Pennsylvania RFRA has done that. In it, the Pennsylvania legislature has done that. As it happens, the Third Circuit said that this restriction did pass strict scrutiny. That question is not before us, but obviously, Pennsylvania courts, as well as the Third Circuit, can decide in any particular case how to apply the statute that the state legislature has indeed enacted to give extra protection for religious observers. I'd also add that, of course, the free speech clause, both as to the freedom of speech affirmatively and as to freedom from speech compulsions, as with the Hurley, the parade case, and the freedom of expressive association, as with Boy Scouts and versus Dale, does secure considerable rights to people to decide what to say and what not to say, what speech not to create, even based on race, religion, sexual orientation, and such, especially when they're doing it themselves. What it doesn't do, what neither the free speech clause nor the free exercise clause would do, I would say, is allow people to insist that the government, when a government kind of delegates this government authority to them, they can exercise that authority the way they want and the way they think is right, as opposed to the way the government does. And what am I worried about in this kind of situation? I'm worried about the same thing that Justice Scalia was worried about. That if the court does say, oh, Employment Division versus Smith was wrong, then we'll be back to case after case in which courts have to decide just how compelling is the interest, and not just as to narrow areas like free speech, let's say, or right to bear arms, which are expressly secured by the Constitution, but as to exemptions from a vast, vast range of laws, so long as somebody has a sincere religious belief. I think that's something that the court rightly avoided, again, as a constitutional matter in Smith, and I don't want to see it get back to that.
Thank you. Stephen Casey is our next question asker.
Good evening. Thank you so much, Judge Elrod and Jordan and Eugene for your participation. I'm a huge fan of all three of y'all. So what I see missing in the conversation and from both sides is this idea of where the social contract arises, right? So in the context of adoption, I don't see the court's reasoning from this perspective. That didn't fall out of the sky on a group of, you know, 50 or 60, 18 year olds who are old enough to consent to start a society. So when government intervenes or government has a standard such as we want adoption to be here, I think the eye always has to be asked in a presuppositional and more fundamental question of what's the role of government? And so if the role of government is 18-year-old, then I'm probably going to be the wildest edge of libertarianism possible. But if the role of government starts off that many families form a clan, many clans form a tribe, and anything internal to that is all kind of tradition and oral, but then from tribe to tribe, you get these formal agreements, which seems that's the nature of a constitution from disparate people groups, from people from Tennessee and people from Maine, then the fundamental role of government is to protect the pre-governmental institution of family. So let's ask the question then, in this context, what is this religious objector doing that's toward or away from the pre-governmental institution of family? If they say, look, we're going to raise this child in this context, that does nothing to harm it. And so they should have the capacity and the freedom to do so. And that will solve, I think, a lot of questions.
Okay, Stephen, I hate to interrupt you because you're so kind, but I think we got the gist of it about what comes first and the origin of how the beginning of this. Jordan, did you want to talk about that?
I have to admit that I have not thought about this a whole lot, the way that he's putting this. I do think that we have a situation here, and maybe I'm missing the point that he's making, where there's some sort of family failure, that there's abuse or neglect of the children. I mean, I think as a general idea, if we're talking about having, mediating institutions that are non-governmental, that, you know, society works better if we have, a small government and strong families and strong churches and other civic institutions. I basically agree with that. What I'm having trouble here is applying it is, if you're having family, a failure where the parents are not raising the kids, what do you do? Now, I know in some of these foster situations, they have kinship care where they want to place the children that are being abused or neglected with family members. And maybe this is getting way more specific than what he was talking about. But sometimes that doesn't exist. So I'm not exactly sure how the concept, at least applied to this situation, would resolve it or be helpful in advancing the analysis. Now, maybe Eugene, who's much smarter than me, will have some thoughts on that.
Well, the Constitution does not enact any particular view about foster care. I think Jordan believes that it enacts a view about how religious institutions may participate in that, but setting aside that question, the Free Exercise Clause question, it doesn't implement any such view. Now, the court has held that the Constitution secures the rights of biological parents. That dates back to Meyer v. Nebraska and Pierce v. Society of Sisters. That definitely is well-founded in American legal history, but there is no constitutional right to adoption. There is no constitutional right to foster care. If the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania wants to run its foster care system in a particular way, the theories that we heard are plausible theories for how you might want to run it, but nothing in the Constitution mandates that. Certainly nothing in the U.S. Constitution. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has its own constitution, which is older than the U.S. Constitution. And maybe there's something can be found in it that requires that, but I don't see how the Bill of Rights or any other feature of the U.S. Constitution requires us to have that kind of conception of foster family structure.
So I think the question had a natural law flavor, that there's something that comes before the Constitution. So,
well, nothing requires Pennsylvania to adhere to some contested vision of natural law.
Okay. Randall Hood.
You're Hi. On, Randall. First off, I was wondering where the government got the authority to open such an office or create such an office, when in fact, are they not prohibited by the general welfare clause, both in the promote the general welfare and provide
I'm sorry to interrupt. I read your comment in the chat. This is the state government. It's not the federal government. It's not a question here of federal government.
Promote the general welfare. And in the promote the general welfare, it states that the creation of or new increase in creation of offices is prohibited when coupled with the Ninth Amendment, which states that you cannot deny or disparage a right in the Constitution that is by the people, which means on the side of the people, which means where the people lose authority to the government, it cannot be created.
Okay. I think we have your question. You want to know where the government has the power to enact this law. And so I think we have your question. Would anyone like to address that?
Well, I think the answer is, the states have plenary power to do those things that there's not forbidden by the federal constitution. Now, again, if you think that there's a specific enumerated right or even unenumerated right that limits the government's authority about how to run the foster care system, well, we'd have to kind of explain why that would be so. There's certainly not a precedent for it that I know of. But unlike the federal government, which is a government of enumerated powers where Congress has to point to a particular provision, as to state governments, at least under the federal constitution, they can do all sorts of things, including deal with foster care. And if you're going to be dealing with foster care, then you have to decide who it is who selects who can provide foster care and what rules they must follow in so selecting.
Thank you. Constantine Politis, or Politis.
Thank you. So as you guys discussed under Smith, the law or the city's actions here isn't neutral or generally applicable if you have a system of individualized exemptions for comparable secular conduct. And here, and this came up a little bit, like the city is telling parents with disabilities that they can't serve as foster parents and they allow exemptions for any reason. And then I think they allow agencies, I believe, to take into account ethnicity. So it seems like some of those exemptions or waivers bring in the conduct that is actually protected under the city's fair practice ordinance, which they kind of, the city of Philadelphia is basing their kind of reason to no longer want to partner with CSS off of originally. So I was wondering, has the city kind of undermined their own interest here, and there's a law really generally and neutrally applicable when they're not even following their own fair practice ordinance, at least arguably not. Thank you.
I think you're correct. And what you're saying is that they are under their own law that they say they're subject to, using the very criteria to place the children, looking at race, religion, marital status, all these forbidden categories, that they're doing this. And I think under Smith, under the individualized exemption portion, they have to explain why they can't extend that to the religious people. Now, if they're saying something like, well, we're doing it for benign reasons and they're doing it for kind of more invidious reasons or something like this, it's at a different place in the process or something like this, then I go back to what Justice Kennedy said in both Obergefell and in Masterpiece Cake Shop, where he's basically calling these beliefs, decent and honorable, and looking for some sort of, you know, mutual coexistence, peaceful coexistence that's going on here. And I think it significantly undercuts the governmental interest asserted by the city of Philadelphia in this case.
So according to the city, the only time they've used race, and I think this covers ethnicity, it was in one situation where a child in city custody had used particular racial slurs, and the city therefore avoided placing that child in a family with members of the race he had insulted. It seems to me that whatever mileage you might get out of a situation where indeed there's sort of case every day, case by case, we'll give an exemption for this, exemption for that, whatever mileage might be gotten in that situation, this kind of very unusual and well-justified exception, if this in fact was unusual, and that's what Neil Katyal, as a lawyer for the city, assured the court, that can't be enough. Another example, I think, is that they do consider disability of a parent, but that's in part because in certain situations, a parent's disability might make it hard for the, a foster parent, might make it hard for them to actually do the job of foster parenting, either in general or as to a particular child. So we have a few situations, it seems to be, at least according to the city's assurances, maybe they're false, but it seems to be that we have a few situations where in trying to find foster families that really are a good fit for the child, they consider factors that normally they would not be allowed to consider. That I don't think is a pervasive case-by-case decision-making process like the way the court characterized the unemployment compensation system.
Can I just comment on that? Is that, I think Neil Katyal, who I've worked with on some cases together with, and I have great respect for, I think was not doing justice in explaining the record which I was looking at. And I think that those discrete examples that you brought up, that's what they were talking about. But I think it's way more pervasive than that. So when there is, and this is the way I would put it, so there are a child or children that need to be placed into foster care. They're looking for a match that is in the best interest of the child. That's basically what's more familiar and won't be, you know, like an alien social environment. So are the family that's being proposed, are they of the same race? Are they of the same religion? Well, these are Jewish kids. Well, we want to put them with a Jewish family. We, you know, things like this. So they're using these criteria of race and religion, for example, to place the children when they're matching them with a family. And it's just not in these isolated cases like Neil was talking about in the oral arguments. And I think it happens all the time. And I think it makes sense. And it's not crazy or bad or anything like that or evil for them to do that. But under the formal legal argument that the city was making, they're blatantly acting illegally under their Fair Practices Act by doing that. And that's what I think is the issue, that they have to then say, well, then why can't we grant it a similar exemption to the Catholic Social Services? And I would say in the way that they were doing it, where they just refer the same-sex couple to another agency. I realize that that's different than what the city's doing, but the city is actually violating their own law that they say they're bound by what they do.
Okay, thank you. We have time for one more question. And the next person up is Hal Elrod. And I guess I should say in full disclosure that I think that that is my husband, who is not a lawyer, so.
Yeah, I am, however, a big I'm a big fan of all three of you. So, Mr. Lawrence, you mentioned, you know, that your ideal output scenario would be, you know, kind of overturning Smith or relooking at Smith, and you know, in the last term, Supreme Court had the Espinoza case, which overturned Blaine amendments, which were, you know, kind of these anti-Catholic state school funding amendments that were passed earlier in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's a parallel, again, not being a lawyer, but is there a trend towards the court maybe taking an increasingly a skeptical look at states' limits on religious or around discretion around religious liberty, either cities or states, where maybe that in the past that was more flexible around that?
This is the way that I would talk about this, is that I think religious liberty cases come in a different, sometimes different categories. And so, for example, you can have a freedom of speech case, like Eugene mentioned. You can have a church autonomy on their internal governance, and those are somewhat different. And you can have a request for an exemption kind of religious liberty case. That's what we have here. That's what we had in Hobby Lobby, some other cases like that. And I think that Espinoza and these other cases are more equal treatment cases, which it doesn't quite fit in the scenario of an exemption case. So when the government says we have a duty under our state constitution's Blaine Amendment, state establishment clause, to single out the religious users and say, you're excluded, that to me is a different kind of question that's being asked than in Fulton, which is, can you get an exemption? And because they're using a deliberate religious category, so it wouldn't fit under Smith. It's not neutral. They're saying everybody can get this $150 tax credit unless you're donating to one that gives to religious schools. Well, that wouldn't even fall under Smith. So these equal treatment things, I think, are different than the exemption type cases. And maybe Eugene could say it better than I just did.
No, I entirely agree with you. And I have long supported the view that the court endorsed in Espinoza, that the free exercise clause prevents the government from discriminating against religion. You can't say we will fund scholarships. Let's say Montana is more complicated than that, but let's take a stylized example. We can't fund scholarships. We won't fund scholarships at religious schools, even though we do fund them at private secular schools. That's discrimination against religion. Free exercise clause prohibits that. The question is, the free exercise clause mandate a certain kind of discrimination in favor of religion? Does it mandate the exemption of religious institutions and individuals from generally applicable laws? There, I think Justice Scalia, who also, by the way, said in an earlier case, the free exercise clause forbids discrimination against religion. I think in Smith, Justice Scalia got it right, that the free exercise clause also does not mandate discrimination in favor of religion.
Why, thank you. Gentlemen, do you have any final thoughts tonight?
I will just say that I think this is an opportunity for the Supreme Court I just think if the people, as we have this cultural conflict over same-sex marriage, I think if people believe that there's safe spaces that are carved out where they can express their opinions, et cetera, without penalty, participate in society, at least at some level, not every situation is going to be the same that we evaluate them. I think we bring more peace to the situation. But if they are feeling like all their safe spaces are being overrun, I don't think that's a good situation for a good way to resolve this whole cultural question.
So I actually agree with that. And sometimes I think it's even these spaces are constitutionally mandated, say by the free speech clause in certain situations.
Yes.
I just don't think they're constitutionally mandated when the government is essentially asking people to give it advice about where to place children in foster homes and is implementing conditions that says, if you're going to have your advice listened to, you've got to follow our rules. That is an area where I think the government can say, this is our program, our rules, and that's that.
Well, this was a very civilized fight night, very erudite fight. I hope that people learned about this case and about religious liberties and this topic, and I'm going to turn it back over to Cole. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, that does it for tonight, everyone. It was a different event than we planned, but I think the conversation was still quite good. So a special thanks to Jordan Lawrence for taking the time out of his schedule to participate. Of course, to Judge Elrod for serving as a thoughtful moderator, to the FedSoc Student Division for helping pull this all together, and of course, to Professor Volok for stepping into the arena on such short notice. Thank you to all of our viewers here, whether you're on Zoom or viewing through YouTube or Twitter. Be sure to keep your eyes peeled for the next Fetty Night Fight, which I'm told will be Festivus themed. Thanks again, and on behalf of the Columbia Law School Federalist Society chapter, have a happy Thanksgiving.